In the waning months of 1944, as the Western Allies tightened their grip on Germany with rapid and relentless advances, a chilling undercurrent surfaced amidst the ruins of the Third Reich. Whispers, like phantom echoes from the shadows, spoke of a clandestine force emerging, one determined to defy the inevitable defeat that loomed over Nazi Germany. This covert group bore the ominous moniker, the SS Werewolves. Conceived in the recesses of Heinrich Himmler's mind, the architect of the SS himself set one man for the job, Hans Adolf Prutzmann. The Werewolves were not to be dismissed as mere remnants of a fallen regime. Instead, they stood as a sinister and calculated strategy, a desperate gambit aimed at turning the tide in the dying days of the Third Reich. Himmler, recognizing the impending collapse, sought to create a force capable of sowing chaos and resistance long after the fall of the Nazi government. The SS Werewolves were not a conventional army. They were a shadowy network of highly trained and fanatically loyal individuals. Selected for their unwavering allegiance to the Third Reich and their ruthless determination, these operatives operated behind enemy lines, employing guerrilla tactics and engaging in acts of sabotage. Their mission was to instill fear, disrupt the advancing Allies, and maintain a semblance of influence even as the regime crumbled. Frank Manuel, an American intelligence officer, started to notice something rather strange and first encountered a distinctive symbol on the Western Allied offensive into the heart of Germany. It was prominently etched onto white walls in the Franconia region of Germany, a simple yet ominous design consisting of a straight vertical line intersected by a horizontal line, featuring a hook at its end. In his memoir, Manuel recounted that many members of the counterintelligence corps initially dismissed it as a hastily drawn swastika and didn't think much of it. However, Manuel possessed a deeper understanding. To him, the symbol held a more ominous significance as it pointed directly to the presence of the Werewolves, a group of German guerrilla fighters. These individuals were strategically positioned and prepared for clandestine attacks, targeting vulnerable individuals such as isolated soldiers in their jeeps, patrolling military police officers, those recklessly venturing out after dark, and even boastful American soldiers taking less traveled routes. With Allied forces advancing into Nazi Germany and the Soviet Red Army applying pressure on the Eastern Front, Adolf Hitler and his top officials resorted to extreme measures in a final attempt to preserve their ideology. Faced with desperation, they delved into the realm of the supernatural for inspiration, resulting in the establishment of two distinct lupine movements. The first of these movements took the form of an official group comprising paramilitary soldiers, while the second manifested as an impromptu assembly of partisan fighters. Although neither of these movements achieved significant military victories, their impact lay in the realm of propaganda and smaller skirmishes. Both initiatives effectively utilized psychological warfare to instill terror and demoralize occupying soldiers. In essence, Hitler and his senior officials, facing the inevitability of defeat, turned to unconventional and mystical ideas as a last-ditch effort to rally support and perpetuate their ideology. Despite the lack of substantial military success, the psychological tactics employed by these lupine movements underscored the potency of propaganda in influencing the perceptions and morale of those on the opposing side. As the late summer and early autumn of 1944 unfolded, Heinrich Himmler set in motion the ominous Unternehmen Werwolf, Operation Werwolf. Tasked with spearheading this covert initiative was SS Obergruppenführer Hans Adolf Prutzmann, who was entrusted with organizing an elite troop of volunteer forces. Their mission: to carry out clandestine operations behind enemy lines. In its initial conception, the Werewolf units were envisioned as counterparts to the well-known Allied special forces such as the Commandos. Crucially, the original blueprint for Operation Werewolf emphasized the adherence of these units to legitimate military or paramilitary structures. Under the oversight of the German High Command, OKW, the Werewolf forces were intended to operate within the confines of uniformed organizations. Unlike the rogue and unconventional nature of some guerrilla forces, the Werewolf units were expected to follow established military protocols, mirroring the behavior of conventional soldiers, even in the unfortunate event of capture. Upon assuming the pivotal role of General Inspector of Special Defense, General Inspekteur für Spezialabwehr, Hans Adolf Prützmann took charge of establishing the nerve center of the force in Berlin, tasked not only with creating the headquarters, but also with organizing and instructing the members of Operation Werwolf. Prützmann's responsibilities were formidable, drawing on his experiences in the occupied territories of Ukraine, where he had closely studied the guerrilla tactics employed by Soviet partisans. Prützmann aimed to impart these strategies to the operatives of Operation Werewolf. Despite Prützmann's intentions and his background in unconventional warfare, post-war interrogations of German officers revealed a critical perspective on the efficiency of his central office. Descriptions of the headquarters mirrored the criticisms of its commanding officer, depicting it as inefficient, weak, and lacking inspiration. The shortcomings were not limited to the physical infrastructure. Disapproval extended to Prützmann himself, with officers characterizing him as vain, idle, and boastful. Walter Schellenberg, who served as the head of foreign intelligence under Heinrich Himmler, reportedly expressed his disapproval directly to Himmler. Schellenberg went so far as to label the entire Operation Werewolf as criminal and stupid. These internal critiques shed light on the operational and leadership challenges that plagued the ambitious endeavor, raising questions about the effectiveness and viability of the Werewolf initiative under Prützmann's guidance. Following the Allied invasion of Normandy, whispers of a covert German guerrilla organization circulated, injecting an atmosphere of mystery and tension into the post-invasion period. The speculation gained enough traction to prompt an article in Time magazine addressing the possibility that the Germans might seek to protract the war indefinitely by adopting an underground strategy in the aftermath of their defeat. A notably detailed account surfaced in the 27 January 1945 edition of Collier's Weekly, authored by Major Edwin Lesner. Lesner's article presented a disquieting scenario, suggesting that elite SS units and Hitler Youth were undergoing specialized training with the explicit aim of launching attacks against Allied forces. The piece began with a quote from Joseph Goebbels in 1944, hinting at a strategy involving the utilization of a fervent population to harass and obstruct the advancing enemy, thereby tying down formidable forces and thwarting any potential exploitation of successes. Major Lesner's ominous article vividly depicted the potential emergence of a Nazi resistance capable of posing a significant threat even after Germany's conventional military defeat. These reports introduced an element of uncertainty and fear among Allied forces, emphasizing the imperative need for continued vigilance in the aftermath of the Normandy invasion. The prospect of a clandestine Nazi force added a layer of complexity to the post-invasion landscape, urging the Allies to remain alert to potential unconventional threats. In October 1944, following the American capture of Aachen, Heinrich Himmler, the leader, initiated the deployment of German Werewolf units in areas occupied by the Western Allies, beginning with Aachen. These covert groups consisted of 3 to 10 individuals each, strategically positioned behind enemy lines in occupied territories. Members operated by seamlessly integrating into civilian populations or seeking refuge in wooded areas. Their primary objectives included disrupting telecommunications, transport infrastructure, utilities, and industrial installations to prevent their use by invading forces. Additionally, Werewolf members were tasked with launching targeted attacks on military personnel and commanders, as well as military hospitals and medical aid stations, creating an environment of insecurity for Allied soldiers. A significant focus of Werewolf operations during this time was identifying and dealing with German traitors and defeatists who encouraged surrender or collaborated with the Allied occupiers. In October 1944, Das Schwarze Korps, an SS organ, proclaimed that individuals holding administrative positions among the Allies would face execution within a month. The Werewolf cells were assigned the responsibility of executing this threat, emphasizing their role in eliminating perceived collaborators and those deemed disloyal to the German cause. In essence, werewolf operatives were directed to carry out a multifaceted campaign involving sabotage, targeted attacks, and the elimination of individuals deemed detrimental to the Third Reich. This initiative reflected a desperate attempt to disrupt the Allied occupation and maintain a semblance of resistance as Germany faced increasing military setbacks in the later stages of World War II. The nocturnal activities of the SS werewolf fighters, who dubbed themselves Deutsche Freiheitskämpfer, German freedom fighters, unfolded with a carefully orchestrated strategy, primarily conducting their operations under the cloak of darkness. These elusive fighters, drawing inspiration from the mythical werewolves, took on an inconspicuous and seemingly harmless persona during daylight hours and in public spaces. However, as night descended, they underwent a metamorphosis into lethal predators, executing their clandestine missions with precision and stealth. This dual nature, where the Deutsche Freiheitskämpfer concealed their true identities by day and emerged as formidable operatives by night, contributed to the eerie and mysterious aura surrounding the werewolf organization. Their ability to seamlessly blend into civilian life during the day allowed them to avoid detection and scrutiny, enabling them to strike when least expected under the cover of darkness. This was especially apparent in the West during the Allied invasion of Germany. Thank you, Private Internet Access, for sponsoring today's video, the world's most transparent VPN provider, with a commendable 30 million downloads. But fear not, for unlike some wartime secrets, Private Internet Access is an open book. They never record or store your sensitive data, and their no-logs policy has withstood the scrutiny of courts and the meticulous inspection of Deloitte. A VPN, or virtual private network, is a technology that allows you to create a secure and encrypted connection over the internet. Now, you may be wondering, how does Private Internet Access shield your digital life? Well, it's like having a secret code, an Enigma machine, similar to what the Germans used, but much better for the modern age. Private Internet Access hides your IP address and encrypts your internet connection, keeping your online maneuvers hidden from the prying eyes of your internet service provider, network administrators, and government censors, just as the Allies hid their strategic plans from the Axis powers. But that's not all. Private Internet Access isn't just a clandestine operation, it's also a source of entertainment. Picture this, you, sitting in your virtual foxhole, with access to all major streaming services, unlocking more content than ever before from any corner of the world. And for those of you engaged in P2P file sharing, fear not, for Private Internet Access supports your noble cause. This powerful VPN is like a trusty weapon, available for all platforms, Windows, macOS, Android, Linux, iOS, and more. And here's the kicker, with just one Private Internet Access subscription, you can protect an unlimited number of devices simultaneously, just like the camaraderie among soldiers fighting side by side. And for those skeptics among us, signing up for Private Internet Access is risk-free. With a 30-day money-back guarantee, you can grab an 83% discount using our link, that's just $2.03 a month, and you also get 4 extra months completely for free at piavpn.com/historyatwar. Historian Perry Biddiscombe, in his comprehensive work Werewolf, the History of the National Socialist Guerrilla Movement 1944-46, provides a broader perspective on the original strategy employed during 1944-45. Biddiscombe notes that the primary goal of the werewolf operations during this period was not necessarily to secure a military victory, but rather to impede the advancing enemy forces. The strategic objective was to create a significant delay, potentially leading to a political settlement that would favor Germany. However, the realization of this plan was ultimately met with failure. One contributing factor to this failure lies in the chaotic nature of the National Socialist bureaucracy, resulting in confusion regarding the origin and coordination of Werewolf's orders. The lack of organizational clarity hindered effective communication and coordination among the guerrilla units. Moreover, the dwindling military supplies further compromised the operation operational effectiveness of werewolf forces, limiting their ability to carry out sustained and impactful actions, the intended use of guerrilla tactics as a delaying measure with the aim of establishing favorable conditions for a political resolution did not unfold as envisioned. However, this was not the end. Let's dive deeper into the propaganda and operation after Aachen of 1944. On March 23, 1945, Joseph Goebbels delivered a pivotal speech known as the Werewolf Speech, marking a significant moment in the trajectory of the werewolf movement. In this address, Goebbels passionately implored every German citizen to embrace a fight-to-the-death mentality. The essence of the speech aimed to instill a sense of unyielding resistance and fanaticism among the German population, emphasizing a commitment to defend their homeland against the advancing Allied forces. Following Goebbels' powerful oration and amidst the increasing chaos of the closing stages of World War II, the organized structure of the werewolf movement experienced partial dismantling. This shift, combined with the impact of the werewolf speech, contributed to considerable confusion in distinguishing subsequent attacks. The blurred lines between actions carried out by genuine werewolf members and those perpetrated by solo acts of fanatical Nazis or small groups of SS operatives created a complex and intricate narrative. The werewolf propaganda station, aptly named Radio Werewolf, commenced its broadcasts from Nauen near Berlin on April 1, 1945. This radio initiative, characterized by its ominous symbolism, initiated transmissions with the evocative sound of a wolf's howl, setting a tone of foreboding anticipation. Accompanying this auditory prelude was a song featuring the lyrics, "My werewolf teeth bite the enemy, and then he's done and then he's gone, who, who, who." The inaugural broadcast delivered a resounding message, declaring that the Nazi Party had issued a directive for every German to stand his ground and do or die against the Allied armies who are preparing to enslave Germans. The ominous proclamation sought to galvanize the German populace for a last stand against the advancing Allied forces. The broadcast outlined a stark mission, designating every Bolshevik, Englishman, and American on German soil as a target for the werewolf movement. The message carried a stern warning, asserting that any German, regardless of profession or social class, who collaborated with the enemy would face the consequences of the werewolf's avenging hand. The broadcast concluded with a chilling declaration of resolve encapsulated in the motto, "Conquer or Die." This rallying cry encapsulated the desperation and determination of the werewolf movement as it sought to instill a sense of unwavering commitment among the German population in the face of impending defeat and occupation by Allied forces. The front page of the April 1945 issue of Front und Heimat, Front and Home, the German soldiers' newspaper, bore a headline that sent a shiver through its readership: "Werewolf is attacking." This bold declaration conveyed a sense of urgency and heightened tension, signaling a call to arms and underscoring the ominous presence of the werewolf movement. The choice of the headline in this soldier-centric newspaper aimed to evoke a spirit of resistance and defiance in the face of the advancing Allied forces. It served as a rallying cry, emphasizing the werewolf's commitment to engaging in covert and guerrilla-style operations against the perceived invaders. While the majority of German civilians were worn down by the prolonged hardships of war and showed little interest in joining a fanatical crusade, pockets of resistance persisted across the country. Despite widespread exhaustion, holdouts remained committed to opposing the Allied occupiers. Instances of snipers taking shots at Allied soldiers, assassinations of German mayors collaborating with the occupiers, and the discovery of weapon caches hidden in forests and near villages highlighted the persistent undertones of resistance. Notably, General George Patton dismissed the notion of a significant threat from these remnants, asserting that the fear of werewolves and murder was baseless. However, the American media and military took a more cautious stance, acknowledging the potential danger posed by partisan fighters. Contrary to Patton's skepticism, one US intelligence report from May 1945 emphatically stated, "The werewolf organization is not a myth, but a danger." This recognition underlined the reality of organized resistance efforts in the last days and post-war Germany. The Werewolf organization, on paper, was purported to possess an extensive arsenal of weapons, ranging from fireproof coats to silenced Walther pistols. However, the grandiose plans outlined in documents starkly contrasted with the stark reality. Werewolf never materialized with the necessary equipment, organization, morale, or coordination. The ambitious vision of a well-equipped and efficient guerrilla force existed solely on paper. Amid the dire supply situation facing German forces in 1945, the commanding officers of existing Wehrmacht and SS units were hesitant to divert their limited resources to support an organization whose strategic value remained dubious. The impracticality of diverting precious equipment to a disorganized and unproven entity like Werewolf further diminished any hope of the organization becoming a potent force. Efforts were made to bury explosives, ammunition, and weapons across the country, with a focus on the pre-1939 German-Polish border region. The intention was for Werewolf to use these caches in resistance fighting following Germany's defeat. However, the quantities of materials buried were minimal, and the movement's disorganization had reached a point where few actual members or leaders were aware of the locations. Consequently, the vast majority of these concealed depots were discovered by Soviet forces, and the materials buried were seldom utilized by Werewolf. The stark disparity between the envisioned capabilities of Werewolf and its actual operational capacity highlights the challenges and limitations that ultimately led to its ineffectiveness as a coherent and formidable resistance movement in the post-war period. The Werewolf organization had a range of tactics at its disposal, encompassing sniping attacks, arson, sabotage, and assassination. Training for Werewolf members was designed to cover a spectrum of skills, including the production of homemade explosives and the manufacturing of detonators using everyday items such as pencils or even a simple can of soup. The emphasis on resourcefulness and adaptability underscored the clandestine nature of the organization. Particular attention was given to unconventional techniques, exemplified by training every member in the art of swiftly infiltrating a guard tower and efficiently strangling a sentry using only a meter of string. This specialized skill set reflected the covert and lethal nature of Werewolf's intended operations. The organization sought to equip its members with the ability to execute precise and deadly maneuvers, emphasizing the importance of stealth and surprise in their guerrilla tactics. Initially, Werewolf boasted around 5,000 members drawn from the ranks of the SS and the Hitler Youth. These recruits underwent specialized training in guerrilla tactics, preparing them for clandestine operations behind enemy lines. Operation Werewolf even took the audacious step of establishing front companies with the aim of sustaining resistance in occupied areas of Germany. Unfortunately, all these front companies were discovered and shut down within 8 months. The original vision included the establishment of an impregnable Alpine fortress, purportedly serving as a strategic command center for Werewolf operations if the rest of Germany succumbed to occupation. However, this vision proved to be yet another delusion, contributing to the transformation of Werewolf in the final weeks of the war. Faced with the reality that the envisioned fortress was unattainable, Werewolf adapted its strategy, shifting from a guerrilla force to a terrorist organization. The change in approach reflected the desperate circumstances of the closing stages of the war. Werewolf, once conceived as a disciplined and covert force, had to adjust its tactics as the grand plans fell apart. The shift to terrorism indicated a more chaotic and less structured form of resistance, illustrating the challenges and disarray that characterized the waning days of Nazi Germany. On April 28, 1945, Staff Sergeant Ib Melchior of the US Counterintelligence Corps achieved a significant breakthrough by capturing 6 German officers and 25 enlisted men in civilian attire. This group claimed to constitute a werewolf cell under the command of Colonel Paul Kruger operating in Schonsee, Bavaria. The capture occurred in a tunnel network where the group had sought refuge, revealing a cache of communications equipment, weapons, explosives, and several months' worth of food supplies. Nearby, hidden in the forest, were two vehicles. Disturbingly, documents found in the tunnels listed US military commanders, with General Dwight D. Eisenhower among the targeted individuals for assassination. Colonel Kruger provided additional insight into the werewolf training program, stating that in 1943, a school was established in Poland with the specific purpose of training individuals in guerrilla warfare. Later, in September 1944, the school was relocated to Tschürenberg, Czechoslovakia. According to Kruger, a total of 100 to 200 men completed werewolf training in less than 2 years. By April 1, 1945, the school had moved to Schonsee, where a subterranean base was constructed. The students received explicit instructions to stay behind, evade capture, and then harass and destroy the supply lines of United States troops, with a particular focus on gasoline and oil supplies. This detailed account captured in the G2 report sheds light on the operational aspects of Werewolf, providing insights into its training infrastructure, relocation efforts, and strategic objectives. The discovery of such an organized and well-equipped cell reinforced the threat posed by Werewolf and underscored the challenges faced by Allied forces in the closing stages of World War II. These operations for this group were scheduled to commence approximately 3 to 4 weeks after the area was occupied by US troops. According to the plan, each unit would be assigned specific targets by the Central Command. Subsequently, groups comprising 10 to 20 individuals would be dispatched to eliminate the designated targets and promptly return to their unit. It was explicitly directed that targets should not be located closer than 15 kilometers to the unit. The success of these operations relied heavily on secrecy and camouflage for security. Strict orders were in place for all personnel to conceal themselves if US troops entered their area, with an absolute prohibition on opening fire in the bivouac area. Notably, no escape routes had been planned. Uniformed in Wehrmacht attire, most members adhered to the military dress code, while a select few adopted the guise of foresters to serve as outposts, reporting potential threats in the vicinity. The arsenal at their disposal included mortars, machine guns, submachine guns, rifles, and various sidearms. Each individual was equipped with a Lilliput pistol designed for discreet concealment. Adequate ammunition supplies for each weapon type were ensured, sufficient for 4 months of standard operations. The strategic approach outlined in this plan not only emphasized the tactical aspects of their mission, but also underscored the paramount importance of maintaining secrecy and adapting to the presence of US troops. The comprehensive preparation, ranging from camouflage and concealment measures to the allocation of weaponry and ammunition, highlighted the organization's commitment to executing covert and sustained resistance operations. Next, the werewolf unit maintained a clandestine infrastructure, concealing a civilian-type sedan and a Wehrmacht motorcycle skillfully in the woods. Additionally, they strategically dispersed 120 horses across farms in the vicinity, providing an alternative means of transportation and escape. To sustain themselves, the unit stockpiled a diverse array of food, including canned meat, biscuits, crackers, chocolate, and canned vegetables, enough to last over 4 months. Supplementary provisions like bread, potatoes, fresh vegetables, and smoked sausages were sourced from local areas. Water needs were met by a nearby brook flowing through the region. Emphasizing environmental preservation, the unit constructed dugouts with meticulous consideration for the surrounding live trees. Situated on the slope of a densely covered hill adorned with fir trees, these dugouts were designed to minimize ecological impact. The entrance to each dugout featured a hole roughly 24 inches in diameter and 4 to 5 feet deep. At approximately 2 feet down, this opening extended horizontally for 8 to 10 feet. Each dugout, accommodating 3 individuals, boasted a wooden floor, a drainage ditch, and reinforced walls and roof constructed with lumber. This careful planning and execution reflected the organization's commitment to both concealment and sustainability, ensuring their operational base remained hidden and environmentally conscious. Earlier, when we discussed about the radio werewolf, according to historian Hugh Trevor Roper, who wrote shortly after the war's conclusion, radio werewolf had no genuine connection to the werewolf military unit. Instead, it was purportedly organized and overseen by propaganda minister Joseph Goebbels. Trevor Roper speculates that Goebbels may have orchestrated the radio initiative with the intention of gaining control over the military unit, which he perceived as inadequately radical. The historian contends that Goebbels' radio werewolf propagated what he describes as an ideological nihilism, a message inconsistent with the limited objectives of the actual werewolf unit. Trevor Roper argues that the divergence between the broadcasts of Radio Werewolf and the genuine purpose and actions of the military unit is the root cause of widespread misconceptions regarding the unit's actual mission. Contrary to popular beliefs, Trevor Roper asserts that the primary goal of the werewolf unit was to mount attacks on the Allies from behind their lines, operating in conjunction with the German army facing the Allies on the front lines. The true intent was not to function as a guerrilla-style resistance unit post Germany's defeat, but rather to engage in strategic operations during the ongoing conflict. Also, in the initial months of 1945, SS Obersturmbannführer Otto Skorzeny found himself entangled in the training of recruits for the werewolf units. However, his involvement quickly led him to a sobering realization. The number of werewolf cells had been greatly exaggerated, and the practical effectiveness of these units as a formidable fighting force was severely limited. Acknowledging the inevitable defeat that loomed over Nazi Germany, Skorzeny, like many other Nazi leaders, came to the pragmatic conclusion that werewolf cells could be repurposed for a different mission. Recognizing the dire situation, Skorzeny redirected the focus of Werewolf, envisioning a role for them in what could be described as a Nazi underground railroad. Instead of futilely resisting the Allied forces, the Werewolves would become instrumental in facilitating escapes along clandestine routes known as rat lines. These routes served as escape pathways for thousands of SS officers and other Nazis seeking to evade capture and flee Germany in the aftermath of the Third Reich's collapse. Skorzeny's strategic shift showcased a pragmatic adaptation to the changing circumstances of the war, emphasizing the prioritization of escape and survival over futile resistance. By transforming Werewolf into an integral part of the Nazi escape network, Skorzeny contributed to the larger post-war narrative of Nazi leaders seeking refuge and anonymity, evading the justice they might have faced for their wartime actions. On March 25th, 1945, a Werewolf cell orchestrated the assassination of Archenmayor Franz Oppenhoff. A prominent Catholic lawyer, Oppenhoff had assumed the mayoral role in Aachen just 5 months earlier, under the auspices of the American military government. His appointment marked a significant departure, as he became the first non-Nazi mayor in Germany since 1933. This distinction made him a particularly notable figure, serving as a symbol of the post-Nazi era. Recognizing Oppenhoff's symbolic importance, especially in the eyes of Heinrich Himmler, the architect of the SS and a key figure in Nazi Germany, the Werewolf cell viewed him as an exemplar to be eliminated. The six-man group responsible for the attack was transported from an airbase near Hanover and subsequently parachuted just over the border into Belgium, orchestrating a covert and targeted operation. The assassination of Franz Oppenhoff reflected the Werewolf's commitment to resisting any semblance of non-Nazi authority and served as a brutal reminder of the challenges faced by those seeking to establish a new order in post-war Germany. Upon reuniting with their compatriots, the team established a camp in the woods near the Belgian hamlet of Hauzet, approximately 90 minutes on foot from Oppenhoff's residence. In this secluded location, the group meticulously finalized their tactical plan. Ilse Hirsch, the group leader, and Morgenschweiss, and Heidorn, the latter experiencing a change of heart, assumed the responsibility of guarding the camp. Simultaneously, Hennemann took the lead, accompanied by Wenzel and Leitgeb, to venture into the town to carry out the targeted assassination. twilight on March 25th, Palm Sunday, marked the commencement of the operation. The gunmen, clad in Luftwaffe coveralls to conceal their identities, embarked on their journey to Aachen. This crucial moment coincided with Franz and his wife Irmgard Oppenhoff attending to their children before heading next door for a social gathering with friends. The cloak of evening served as the backdrop for the clandestine mission, adding an air of secrecy and intensity to the unfolding events. The calculated timing underscored the determination and precision with which the werewolf operatives executed their plan, highlighting the ruthless and covert nature of the mission they were about to undertake. Shortly after 9 p.m, the assassins reached Oppenhoff's residence, with Wenzel and Leitgeb gaining entry through a basement window. Upon discovering that only the children and the housekeeper were present, they roused the housekeeper and concocted a fabricated story. They claimed to be downed German airmen in need of passes from Oppenhoff to facilitate their return to their own lines. Reacting to the urgency of their supposed situation, the housekeeper hurried to summon the Burgermeister. As Oppenhoff arrived with his neighbor in tow, Wenzel and Leitgeb waited outside. The housekeeper, upon returning, was sent back inside to prepare sandwiches, leaving Oppenhoff engaged in conversation with the purported airman. Meanwhile, the neighbor, sensing something amiss, excused himself and hastened to alert the Americans. With their quarry now alone, the assassins seized the opportunity and did their calculated move. The convergence of deception, urgency, and isolation set the stage for the fateful moment that would alter the course of Oppenhoff's life. Wenzel, who had initially undertaken the responsibility of carrying out the shooting, faltered when the critical moment arrived. Despite assurances to his accomplices that he would execute the act, he found himself overwhelmed by nerves. Holding a silencer-equipped Walter automatic in his trembling hand, Wenzel hesitated, standing frozen even as Leitgeb urged him to take action. Frustrated by Wenzel's inaction, Leitgeb seized the pistol and, with a sense of disdain, declared, "Heil Hitler!" before firing a fatal shot into Oppenhoff's brain. Having accomplished the grim task, the hulking Austrian alerted Hennemann, who had been standing watch in a nearby vacant lot. With the mission completed, the assassins swiftly disappeared into the cover of the night, leaving behind a scene marked by treachery, a silenced pistol, and the lifeless form of Franz Oppenhoff. The execution of the plan unfolded with a blend of tension, discord, and ruthless determination, capturing the stark brutality of the werewolf operation on that ominous night. On March 28, 1945, the mayor of the eastern Ruhr town of Meschede fell victim to an assassination, despite the fact that Meschede remained behind German lines and was not overtaken until mid-April. Subsequently, Werewolf Radio broadcasted an announcement claiming responsibility for the assassination, attributing the act to werewolf agents. This incident exemplified the werewolf organization's capacity for clandestine and targeted operations even in areas ostensibly under German control, underscoring their commitment to resistance and disruption until the closing stages of the war. On the morning of April 28, 1945, the Bavarian Freedom Campaign broadcast a message on the radio. The war was declared over for Bavaria. The former mayors deposed by the National Socialists in 1933 were asked to take up their positions again. In Penzberg, the former SPD mayor Hans Rummer, 1880-1945, prevented the mine from being blown up, ensured the liberation of forced laborers and prisoners from neighboring camps, and deposed the National Socialist mayor. While attempts were made to reconstitute the democratic city administration that had been eliminated during the National Socialist seizure of power, the 22nd Heavy Thrower Regiment of the 18th People's Thrower Brigade, which had only been set up in February 1945, surrounded the town hall. After approval from the Munich Gauleiter, Paul Giesler, the regiment's commander Berthold Ohm, had Rummer and seven of his comrades in arms shot. To do this, they were driven at 6 p.m. in a bus with covered windows near the sports field on Bickler Strasse, and each of the victims was shot individually. A unit werewolf, led by the well-known war writer and SA brigade leader Hans Söberlein, joined the Werfer regiment after this shooting campaign. During the subsequent punitive operation, this unit murdered a further 8 people as a flying court-martial who were arbitrarily considered to be resistors, including Agatha Fleisner, a pregnant woman. According to Biddiscombe, the spectre of Nazi partisan warfare, particularly the werewolf activities, had a detrimental impact on overarching policy decisions among the occupying powers. This apprehension prompted the implementation of severe reprisal measures, leading to the destruction of significant German property and the loss of thousands of civilian and military lives. Ian Kershaw further asserts that the fear of werewolf activities potentially motivated Allied troops to commit atrocities against German civilians both during and immediately following the war. The pervasive concern about clandestine resistance may have contributed to a climate of suspicion and harsh reprisals, creating a complex and challenging environment during the post-war occupation period. The German resistance movement was effectively quelled in 1945. Despite this, punitive measures for acts of resistance, including fines and curfews, persisted as late as 1948. Biddiscombe estimates that the cumulative death toll, directly attributable to werewolf actions and the ensuing reprisals, ranged between 3,000 and 5,000 individuals. The prolonged impact of the werewolf campaign and the subsequent responses underscored the lingering challenges and consequences faced during the post-war period in Germany. The estimates reflect the toll exacted by both the covert resistance and the harsh measures taken to suppress it, leaving a lasting imprint on the aftermath of World War II. In the Soviet occupation zone, a significant number of youths were apprehended under the label of werewolves. The arrests, as reported, were often arbitrary and influenced in part by denunciations. Those arrested, primarily boys, faced 2 grim fates: execution or internment in NKVD special camps. On June 22, 1945, Deputy Commissar of the NKVD Ivan Serov conveyed to the head of the NKVD, Lavrenty Beria, that over 600 alleged werewolf members had been detained. The majority of these individuals were reported to be between the ages of 15 and 17 years old. The widespread arrests and severe measures taken by Soviet authorities in the aftermath of the war reflected the perceived threat posed by the werewolf organization, contributing to a complex and tumultuous post-war landscape in the Soviet-occupied zone. The report, although citing instances where Soviet units encountered gunfire from wooded areas, indicates that a substantial number of those arrested had not participated in any actions against the Soviets. Ivan Serov, in explaining the situation, claimed that interrogation results revealed the arrested youths had been waiting for the opportune moment and, in the interim, were primarily focused on recruiting new members. In October 1945, Lavrenty Beria reported to Joseph Stalin the liquidation of 359 alleged werewolf groups. Among them, 92 groups with 1,192 members were reportedly liquidated in Saxony alone. On August 5, 1946, Soviet Minister for Internal Affairs, Sergei Nikiforovich Kruglov, disclosed that in the Soviet occupation zone, 332 terrorist diversion groups and underground organizations had been discovered and liquidated. Approximately 10,000 youths were interned in NKVD special camps, with half of them failing to return. Information about the whereabouts of the arrested youths was withheld from parents, as well as from the East German administration and political parties established by the Soviets. Eisenhower held the belief that he would confront extensive guerrilla warfare, particularly centered around the Alpine Redoubt. The perceived threat of werewolf activity gathering around Berchtesgaden in the Alps prompted a strategic shift in US operational targets in mid-March 1945. Instead of advancing towards Berlin, the focus shifted southwards with the aim of linking up with the Russians first. A strategic intelligence report emphasized the need to be prepared for operations in southern Germany to swiftly overcome any organized resistance by the German armed forces or potential guerrilla movements retreating to the inner zone and the redoubt. On March 31st, Eisenhower communicated to Roosevelt his optimism about launching operations that would, in part, hinder the possibility of guerrilla control over extensive areas, especially in the southern mountain bastions. This strategic shift underscored the influence of the perceived werewolf threat on Allied military planning during the final stages of World War II. Eisenhower had previously made a request that the Occupation Directive JCS 1067 not hold him responsible for maintaining living conditions in Germany under the anticipated circumstances. He foresaw the likelihood of guerrilla fighting and potentially even civil war in certain districts. In expressing his concerns, he stated, "Probably guerrilla fighting and possibly even civil war in certain districts." In expressing his concerns, he stated, "Probably guerrilla fighting and possibly even civil war in certain districts. If conditions in Germany turn out as described, it will be utterly impossible effectively to control or save the economic structure of the country, and we feel we should not assume the responsibility for its support and control." The British response to this suggestion was described as mortified, but the War Department took significant account of Eisenhower's wishes. Furthermore, the number of civilians held by the US authorities increased dramatically, from 1,000 in late March to 30,000 in late June, and exceeding 100,000 by the end of 1945. Conditions in the camps for civilians were often reported to be poor, reflecting the complex challenges and humanitarian concerns faced by the Allied forces during the post-war occupation of Germany. In April 1945, Churchill made an announcement that the Allies would detain all captured German officers for as long as a guerrilla threat persisted. This policy resulted in hundreds of thousands of German last-ditch troops being held in makeshift Rheinwiesenlager for extended periods, primarily aimed at preventing potential werewolf activity. Before the occupation, SCHAF, Supreme Headquarters Allied Expeditionary Force, investigated the reprisal techniques that the Germans had employed to maintain control over occupied territories, acknowledging their perceived success. Directives were loosely defined, and the implementation of reprisals was largely left to the preferences of the various armies. The British, in particular, seemed uncomfortable with measures involving bloodshed. Rear Admiral H.T. Bailey Groman, for instance, expressed that killing hostages was not in accordance with our usual methods. Due to sentiments like these and relatively light guerrilla activity in their area, the UK zone of operations experienced relatively few reprisals. The Allied approach to occupation and reprisals reflected the complexity of post-war governance and the challenges of balancing security concerns with humanitarian principles. And I think I have been over everything. I guess you now have infinite knowledge of this group during and after World War II. Thank you for joining me on this chilling journey into the mysterious world of the German Werewolf SS. If you found this exploration fascinating, don't forget to give us a thumbs up, hit that subscribe button, and ring the notification bell for more intriguing historical content. Remember to check out our Patreon and Instagram. Over on Patreon, I post behind-the-scenes content and a place you can support us. Also, please do share your thoughts, theories, and any other historical mysteries you'd like us to unravel in future videos. We love hearing from our community of history enthusiasts. Once again, thank you for being a part of our journey through history. Until next time, stay curious, stay informed, and keep exploring the mysteries of the past. Goodbye for now.